Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
That was the voice of one of my mentors and friends, Brian Brown, who created the Brown Briefly. Together, we, the Brieflies, keep Brian's creative flame alive by bringing you every week another episode of intelligent, or at least hopefully intelligent, discussion of current events laced with humor and empathy, always guided by Brian's mantra of less is more, more or less. Let me introduce the Brieflies and our guest. So, engineering the show from behind the board at Voice of Vachon's Gene Bosch broadcast studio in bustling and bodacious downtown Vachon is our intrepid pilot, Truman O'Brien.
Good morning. Good morning. God, it's got everybody in the studio today. Well, except Kevin. But
Yes. Yeah. Well, and speaking of Kevin, Kevin is somewhere to the north on his boat Opus, cruising toward the Broughton Islands, which are up at the entrance of Johnstone Strait, the sort of south entrance of Johnstone Strait. So Kevin will be gone for a few months. He'll hopefully be able to zoom in when he's in a marina and has Wi-Fi access. But when he's out on the hook, he's enjoying the solitude. And also, let me introduce our community motivator and fairy maven, Amy Dreher.
Good morning.
How are you, Amy?
I'm doing all right. I'm doing all right. Hoping to take a ride on the ghost boat soon.
Ooh. Yeah. What's the ghost boat?
We have a third unassigned boat on the Triangle route, starting with the summer schedule this week. That is the big news. They have given us a ghost boat. So we'll keep to the two-boat schedule, and the boat will just sort of ride around batting cleanup and help us stay on schedule.
A utility infielder type of
That's
boat.
Exactly right. It's the Salish, which I understand isn't quite fast enough, maybe, if I heard right, to keep up with the run. But we've got it as crewing and vessel allows on the weekdays. So great. It is some relief.
Excellent. That would be a help. Also joining us and across from Truman in the studio is our distinguished legalista, Craig Bellis. Craig, how are you doing? How is this week treating you?
Good, very good. I'm fine. I'm hoping that the ghost boat has more than a ghost crew running it. But with my two children and granddaughter coming over here in the next few days, I'm thrilled that their third boat is filling in whenever it can.
So interesting. Maybe we should start collecting all the ghost fairy stories around Vachon. I'm sure there are lots of them to go along with our new ghost fairy. And joining us today is Islander and Mosquito Fleet historian Gene Finley. Gene is a co-author with me of the photo history of Vachon Maury Islands and is co-author with Robin Patterson of the Mosquito Fleet of South Puget Sound. Welcome, Gene.
Hi, Bruce. It's nice to be here. Thank you for asking me.
Good to have you here. Also, Gene is a historian of the island, but she and Robin worked together to put that South Puget Sound book together. And if you haven't read it, it's a fascinating read, and particularly the chapter on Vachon Island, where you really get a sense of what the island experienced during the Mosquito Fleet days. And, of course, I'm historian Bruce Hallman. So as our usual practice, let's take a moment and check in with everybody about special things you experienced this week. Amy, what are your special experiences?
I have to say we had a great time this past Wednesday doing a thank you for the Washington State Ferry Cruise. We dropped off some goodies and some thank you cards to the docks. And I hear Pizza Joint sent some pizza down for the North End dock. And, you know, it was a really good opportunity. We're going to keep kind of encouraging folks to say thank you to our crews, because we know it is a very difficult job and they are out there all day, every day, in every kind of weather. And we, I think, it on Vashon want working on the boats to be the best job in the state. So we're going to kind of keep up with the initiative to thank our crews. And we had a little junket come over. We had folks from Washington State Ferries, Representative Alvarado, Senator Wynn, last Wednesday, who joined us with the superintendents, Matt Vinci from the fire district, Tim Johnson from the healthcare district, and Slade McSheehy from the school district. We all sat down at the Grange Hall, WSF, our legislators, and our superintendents. And we had sort of a little Camp David, as I referred to it. We had a sort of a retreat at the Grange Hall, and we spent about an hour in roundtable. And, Jessica Anikar from the community council joined us. And we had a really good discussion. Talked about, just kind of reiterating our gratitude for the boats, kind of how we started, and then talked about, solutions. And WSF gave a great update on what's going on. The legislators, of course, Representative Alvarado secured the funding for the water taxi for us. So, sort of they reiterated their commitment to the island. And it very much was a good sort of Camp David moment of coming together, mm-hmm. and acknowledging the difficulties in the system and the difficulties WSF faces, while also acknowledging that, the situation isn't really acceptable for our community. And so it was a good sort of step forward and kind of keeping the channels open. Great. And really enjoyed that day.
Did any peace accords?
At the end of that, after that Camp David, I had a Malta summit. Justin Hirsch and I, from the FAC, Vashon FAC, and we sat down with the Fauntleroy community leadership, Mike and Frank over there, and sort of, we have been sort of hammering out an agreement between our two communities.
That needs a peace agreement.
It does. And we have, they sent a draft over, and I sent a draft over, and we are kind of in the midst of coming together on what our communities do agree on, right? A big piece of which is active management of the line on Fauntleroy Way. That's kind of our, the crux of our joint statement from the communities that we're pulling together.
We've come a long way from when Vashonites were jumping off the dock, attempting to swim to Vashon.
Or meeting the boats with bats and pitchforks, right?
Which I think
turning them away.
About 25 years ago or whatever that was.
Yeah. You know?
So Truman, how has your week been?
Oh man, I've had really a fun week. Thursday, I have to tell you, just over the top, I went to the third grade class, putting on the plays, Helping Homeless Pets, a play in four parts with musical interlude in between the plays. I'm telling you, those kids just knocked it out of the park.
Amazing.
I mean, the writing was excellent. The narrators were fabulous. The first little girl was so cute. She was talking so fast, thinking about it, I didn't understand what she had to say. She read it perfectly, but boy, it was fast. She was a little nervous, I think. But the kids acted the parts very well. They had three little kids were the dogs. They decided the cats were too hard to do, so they just did dogs. But anyway, it was very cute. I have to tell you, it was just great.
So maybe she's training to be a TV announcer.
It could be. Yeah. Then I went to lunch at Palouse Winery. They had a really nice thing for their members. It was just fantastic. Paella in the park or in the back
the patio.
The patio, yeah, mm-hmm. Fabulous. And of course, on Sunday night, had to watch House of the Dragon.
Ooh.
I don't know if you guys have seen that, but oh boy. Yeah, exactly. Anyway, that was my week.
Oh, sounds like an exciting week.
Yeah, it was.
So, Jean, how are you doing?
Doing well. My week was my 14-year-old granddaughter came with her mother. They're from Minneapolis. And so we did Vashon things, the beach, the troll, eating out at our fabulous restaurants and farmers market. But the kind of stellar Vashon moments, one afternoon we had a bald eagle take a fish right in front of our house. Mm. But the fish was so heavy that the eagle was submerged up to its neck in the water, except for its wings. And I can't, I'm really bad at estimating distances, but he had to have been at least 50 feet out from shore, and the tide was higher than we thought, and he swam to shore.
Oh, my gosh.
Just those wings out of the water and push, and his mate was in the top of one of our fir trees, just raising a ruckus. I think, you know, she knew he was in trouble. But he swam, and he made it to shore. But unfortunately, he landed on the other side of someone else's float on the beach. We couldn't see how big the fish was. But we did see him flying in the sky afterwards. So that was just unbelievable.
Wow.
And our other lovely moment was we had salmon for dinner one night. And then the entertainment is you take the fish skin down and feed it to the rock crabs. Yeah. They love that almost more than the
They don't get that in Minneapolis very often, right?
No.
Don't have any of that in Minneapolis.
I just have to tell you, you know, Ted, oh gosh, I'm going blank now. But anyway, they had an eagle take a salmon and fly over their yard, and it got excited and dropped the salmon in their backyard. So they had barbecue salmon at night delivered by the eagle.
Yeah, Ted Claybaugh told me about that.
If you can get it before your dog rolls
it.
Exactly.
So, Craig, how was your week?
My week was, you know, I can't remember. I didn't check my calendar. I can't remember what happened beyond an hour ago, I think. No, actually, we had a good week. I had to work for part of the week. Work! Conducted a couple of hearings, arbitrations. But I did get to go see Tim Couldn't Make It down at Dig Deep with Bruce Fares. And, you know, it was a wonderful evening down there. And then on Father's Day, I had great messages from my kids, which really made my day. And then Lynette and I went to a Gemini party at Janice Randall and Ron Gwaith's house, where a whole bunch of people who are Geminis have their birthdays, and we do that every year. And it was a good gathering. So that's about as much as I can remember.
Sounds like a good week, too.
Yeah. How about you, Bruce?
My week was... mine's one of those weeks where you sort of think, you begin to realize, man, I'm getting old. I started the week last week with, I'd cleaned out the sheds over the weekend. So Monday morning when I woke up, my back, I just, you know, I tweaked it somehow, you know. And it's one of those things where every time you move, you're not sure whether an ice pick's going to be driven into your back or not. You know, most of the time it's okay, but then you take that wrong step and it's sort of like, ugh. And then last night I'm coming down the stairs and all of a sudden, bam, one of my calf muscles just goes on me. It's sort of like, and it hurt. And I'm thinking, man, I'm not that old, am I?
Well, I told you what a friend of mine said. It's not the age, it's the side effects that get you.
Exactly, right.
But I have to tell you, Bruce, I saw you at the hardware store at the Island Lumber the other day. And when you walked in, I said, boy, Bruce is looking old. Something's wrong with him. It was your back that was
exactly,
getting you.
Yeah, I saw that. Oh, yeah. Man. But
we got to get you into yoga.
Oh, yes, yeah. Right. Stretching.
Yeah, there we go.
Or a hot tub.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I do. I hop in the hot tub and get those jets on those muscles.
It helps a lot.
But also Father's Day was just wonderful. We had the grandkids and the kids out. And that's always a kick. And you just see, I mean, one of them's a little over two. I have two five and six-year-olds and two 10-year-olds. And so the house is just sort of like, it's like a bee's nest, you know, just sort of moving around all the time. And it's sort of like, and when they leave, it's sort of like, you take a deep breath and it's sort of like, oh, it's back to quiet again.
It's hard to get used to the silence, though, after you have all that boiling about.
It really is. It's sort of like, wow, all of a sudden it's just Pam and I looking at each other thinking, okay, what do we talk about now? Oh, wow. Well, today is the 18th of June?
Yep.
And it's a very special day, as are all days. It's 31 days until Strawberry Festival, coming up fast. 17 days, and we're in the countdown until the Heritage Museum opens. And Gene Finley has been curating the new Edson Gallery. You want to talk just a minute about the Edson Gallery?
Well, it's going to be nice to have enough space to hang more than, you know, three pictures at a time. So, but what we've tried to do is choose a compendium of his kind of work, mm-hmm. because he had hand-tinted photos and gold-toned photos, and you'll have to come and see what those are. Edson had a really varied life before he came to Vashon. He trained as an artist, went to school in Paris, and then as a young man, starting out when he was about 19, he just sort of left home and became itinerant and wandered around the Northeast and the Midwest, picking up jobs that he could find to keep body and soul together. And he worked at an enormous number of different jobs, all of which trained him to be what he became as a photographer here on the island. He was a sign painter. He learned how to, I can't remember the word for it, remaster negatives, you know, to go through and clean up negatives for publication. He roofed a church with a very steep roof, and he was an interior designer. He did construction on houses, and he learned how to make paperback books using birch bark as the paper for the covers. Just on and on and on. And you can see that in his work.
What years were these? What years?
He was born in 1879,
oh, okay.
I think.
Okay. So it's in the early 1900s then.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, just in the late 1890s.
Right.
And then he went out to Everett. He'd met a girl and he followed her to Everett from Iowa. And while he was there, he took up photography. She was a photographer herself, and she lent him his camera. Mm. And some of his most famous pictures are of logging camps in Everett and of the Tlalip Indians that we have copies of in our collection. Then, you know, he went back. He got married. He had family. And they decided they would come back out to Washington. And he was looking for a small community and ended up on Vashon Island at Burton. And the rest is history.
Yeah. The story I heard is that he arrived in Vashon in the early 20s, 22, 23, something like
22.
22, yes. But I understand he had gone from Everett to Tacoma to look at Tacoma, and, you know, looking for a place to live. And he mistakenly got on the wrong boat and ended up in Burton.
That's essentially the story.
And walked off the boat and looked around Burton. There was a little house for rent. So he just decided this is the place. He went back and he talked to his wife. And I said, I found this little paradise. There's a beach and there's a house and there's a place for my studio. So let's move to Vashon Island.
You know why he really came here? The one thing he was looking for was a small community in which to raise his family with no other photographer.
Right.
So he met all those demands.
And he became sort of the island photographer. So he has an incredible record because he was a working photographer. So he did studio portraits. He did landscapes. He did flowers. He did birds. He did school pictures. He did, you know, and it's a little bit of everything.
A little bit of everything,
a classic little small-town photographer.
He had a view from his studio room, which was in the house to begin with, where he could see Mount Rainier. And that was another huge selling point. He called Washington a landscape paradise, and its best feature was the mountain. And he took over 60 views of the mountain in his lifetime. And every one of them were bestsellers.
Exactly. So another Vashon success story. Sort of catch the wrong ferry and you're in paradise, right?
My first trip to Vashon, I got in the Southworth line. I did not know. Yeah, and I had to back and back and back. And finally they said, what are you doing? I said, I'm going to Vashon. Oh, they were not happy. Those ferry workers.
I can imagine.
Line cutter.
I was almost.
Exactly, right. So today in history, interesting day, in 1815. This is the day that the Duke of Wellington and General von Blücher defeated Napoleon Bonaparte at the Battle of Waterloo. It's also the day in 1873 when Susan B. Anthony was fined $100 for attempting to vote in the 1872 presidential election. And it was a day in 1940 that Churchill delivered his finest hour speech. This was right after the defeat at Dunkirk and sort of the evacuation of the British army back to England from France. And it is a very moving speech, but he concludes it with these words, "Let us therefore brace ourselves for our duties and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its Commonwealth last for 1,000 years, men will say, this was their finest hour." This is also the date in 1983 when Sally Ride becomes the first American woman in space. And last year, just a year ago, this is the day the Titan submersible imploded, viewing the wreck of the Titanic. Which is an interesting sort of segue to Gene Finley talking about the Mosquito Fleet and sort of the implosion that's going on right now with the Washington State ferry system. So, Gene, you've already talked about how Norman Edson arrived on Vashon. Tell us your story. How did you get to Vashon?
I got married.
Simple as that.
That's it every time.
Story's over.
My husband and I met in an English class at the University of Washington, and it turned out that a long time ago, his parents had bought a house here on the island, and they lived here during the 1940s. But his dad was a civil engineer, and they moved around a lot. And when they came back, they retired to Vashon, except that the house they had bought was really a beach cabin. And for older people, as my husband and I learned, not inhabitable if you're elderly. And so they bought a house at Corbin Beach, and then Gilbert and I, my husband and I, got to live in the house, the beach cabin, and most of our summers were spent here during our working years. And we decided we wanted to retire, so we've been here 20 years now. And that's how I came to Vashon. But I want to point out, I'm an island girl. And the first thing that anyone said to me when I was in the grocery store and I told a grocery clerk we were moving here in a couple of years for our retirement. And they said, "You know about the ferries, don't you?" Well, I grew up on Anderson Island, so I was riding ferries before I was born.
Yeah.
and the Vashon ferries look like heaven compared to the Anderson Island ferry.
Oh, the Anderson Island ferry carried 9 cars.
Oh, 9 cars. Wow.
That was... the Toonerville trolley of the ferry boat world.
Wow.
Well, and you weren't even able to go to high school on Anderson Island because they didn't have a high school,
Sixth
right?
grade was the last grade on Anderson Island, one-room schoolhouse. Hmm. And then take the ferry, commuted to junior high and high school, yeah. So I went to Clover Park High School.
Wow.
And I got up so early to get to the ferry, to get to school on time, and the days were so long that to me to sleep in till 8 o'clock, so when I went to college, it was just heaven. I never had to get up at 6 again.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. Some of us wouldn't register for a class that if it began before noon.
Exactly.
I had a lot of friends like that.
you were an original commuter student, which is reviving our school district, that's for sure.
Yes. We commuted. There were like 5, 6, maybe 7 of us from the island. It varied. But the McNeil Island boat brought in all the children from all the people who worked on McNeil Island at the prison. So they had a boatload, and we filled a school bus then when it came to take us into high school. So, commuter from a very early age.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's not quite Mosquito Fleet, but I am
obsessed a little bit with the mosquito fleet these days and PO service. So can you kind of give us a background? I think there's so many lessons we can learn from the mosquito fleet and things that we can understand. And of course, you are the right person to ask about it. So tell us a little, like, how did the mosquito fleet come about? What were the challenges? What can we learn?
Well, the mosquito fleet, you couldn't live in the interior in the beginning. So when settlers first came to Washington, the easiest place to settle was on the shorelines because, as Murray Morgan, a Tacoma historian, said, it was the watery freeway. And often they settled at the mouths of creeks or rivers because there was water power there so that they could power a mill or some other kind of business like that. So logging camps and fishing camps and, you know, people just gathered naturally at these places. So it didn't matter whether you lived on an island or on the mainland. You had the equal opportunity to travel any place that you needed to go. Roads didn't come till a lot later. So the first steamboat on the Sound was the Beaver, which was a Hudson's Bay Company boat, and it went between Puget Sound and Vancouver. It burned about, it burned a lot of wood. They carried three woodcutters on the boat, and it wasn't a very big boat to begin with, but you had to keep it fueled. And gradually, more boats arrived. The first American-made boat was brought up from San Francisco. The second boat on the Sound was the Fairy, and she was so small that they brought her up on the deck of a sailing ship, but she was the first American-made boat that we had here. And gradually, people built boats. First, the boats were one owner, you know, the captain did everything. He built the boat. He ran the boat, he fired the boat, he cut the wood for the boat. And gradually, people hired crew to help them. They built bigger boats. And you started out with a small boat, and then as your business grew, you would discard that boat and build a newer, bigger, better boat, you know. Not necessarily more efficient in terms of fuel. But that was how the business got started. That's the beginning of it. And I would say its heyday is kind of between 1890 and beginning to taper off before 1920. Mm-hmm. Because at that point, there's ferry boats and there's a demand for ferry boats because we've got cars and the cars need to move and there are roads and there are trolleys. Mm-hmm. So you need to move people for those reasons as well.
Mm-hmm. So how does it get the name the Mosquito Fleet?
Oh, I love this story. Somebody standing in his office overlooking, and I hope it was a newspaper office, overlooking Elliott Bay. It was rush hour, and at this point there was a lot of commuter traffic between Seattle and Bremerton, say, back and forth. And he looked down at the bay, and here were all these boats coming and going, and he said, "Looks like a swarm of mosquitoes." And that's how it got the name, Mosquito Fleet.
Excellent. Yeah, I just have this image in my head of kind of the aerial view of the Sound and just boats coming and going in the South Sound
everywhere.
And the North Sound. And like just I can kind of picture it, and it's lovely.
That was called a fleet, but it was, you know, I mean, we have the fleet of boats that belong to the Washington State Ferries, and they're all owned by the same entity. What we called the Mosquito Fleet was just your image, this group of boats coming and going, mm-hmm. but lots of different owners and lots of competition.
Yeah, lots of very, very interesting competitions between the boats, very fierce competitions.
Fierce competitions, well, yes.
That brings up an important part, a point. The fact that the Washington State Ferries are all, you know, in a fleet. And so, therefore, maintenance should be standardized, you know, throughout that fleet.
Should be.
Yeah, I know. That was the key word there, should. But so the Mosquito Fleet had to have major issues with maintenance and all those things. So did they experience the same kind of problems that we have with our Washington State Ferries? I mean,
Oh, in spades.
Yeah,
yes.
I think. Yeah.
Because there were wooden-hulled boats. So, you know, you were constantly having to fix leaks for one thing. And they would bump into things, whether deliberately or not, you know, dependent on whether they were...
what competition.
Whether they were racing to the dock with another boat. But just general maintenance of that sort, you know, they might bump a dock accidentally and they need a repair. Or they would be in a deep fog and not notice that there was a
deadhead or...
You know, a great big boat there. And one of the boats... hit the anchor that was sticking out from the hull of the bigger boat and got a big rip in its hull. Well, you know, you've got to fix that. And their engines constantly needed tinkering. Things wore out. Gaskets would go. Boilers would wear out or rust out or whatever, you know. And sometimes they would have to wait a long time for parts. They couldn't possibly be fabricated or, you know, bought off the shelf here in Seattle or Tacoma.
Were there many sinkings, do you know of?
Actually, the sinkings are really famous. Oh. If they did sink, you know, you know about it. Two boats hit and one sank and a lot of lives were lost in that case. Oh. No, I had a friend that read the book who said she couldn't finish it because every time she turned the page, another boat burned to the waterline. So there was more danger from fire. But there weren't very many safety precautions. And so your engineer would throw the oily rag into the corner, and then they would, you know...
catch fire or whatever.
They would catch fire, and the crew would go home in the evening, and they would not be there when the fire started. And
There was no ocean wisha around at that point to sort of regulate safety on the boats. And there was very limited licensing at that point. I mean, the captains were licensed.
Well,
the boats were...
you did have to have an engineer's license.
Right.
And you did have to have a captain's license, but deckhands were not necessarily. Mm-hmm. And the people who assisted the engineers... weren't licensed that I know of. But you did have to pass a fairly rigorous test to become a captain or an engineer. But no, it was pretty loose.
That raises all kinds of questions for me. Do you know how many docks there were at the peak that the Mosquito Fleet used to come in on Vashon? Either you or Bruce, do you know?
Well, Bruce, that's a good question because I know that this year, getting ready for the new exhibit, that a lot of research has been done on how many docks. Now, not all at the same time, but do you have a total? I've estimated around 34.
Yeah, wow. that's right. You know, it's a little hard because there were three quartermaster docks. There were four different docks at Ellisport, you know, at different times.
What
are the number? But 33, 34 is pretty much the generally accepted number. You know?
And how many boats at the peak would be coming to Vashon?
It sort of varied. I mean, there was the McDowell fleet.
Over time, he had seven different boats, but they didn't all run at the same time. So he maybe had two boats running at the same time.
Right.
Yeah. And in Quartermaster Harbor, Vashon Navigation and
Burton.
The other one.
Yeah. Burton Navigation.
Burton Navigation,
yeah, right.
I think.
Yep. Yep. Right.
They each had about two boats at the same time, even though they owned more boats over time.
Yeah.
And then Christensen on the other side maybe had two boats. So 2, 4, 6, 8.
Yeah.
So if you wanted to get off the island in a hurry, you could probably get a boat somewhere fairly quickly?
Yes and no. I mean, yes, potentially.
I mean, depending on where you're going,
but,
of course.
But the problem was getting from dock to dock because there weren't a lot of roads. So if you were over on the west side at Cove and the Virginia boat headed towards Seattle, you didn't really have much option. You couldn't get across the island and catch a McDowell boat. It would take you longer than it would to wait for the next Virginia boat. So,
exactly.
So that's the issue.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Yeah, you know, I remember we had, during our Telling Stories series from VCC, we had a group of elderly gentlemen who talked about as being kids, that you couldn't go from one side of the island to the other. You had to take a boat to get around because there are no roads.
That would be the quick way to take the boat from one side to the other.
Yeah, one side of the island to the other. I thought that's fascinating to me.
That's true of all of Puget Sound.
Yeah.
Maybe I missed it, but the Mosquito Fleet, did the Mosquito Fleet include any car-carrying boats?
Well, they carried cars, yes, but they weren't car-carrying.
Okay. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yes. occasionally, my favorite story is someone had some machinery they wanted to ship to Seattle, and I think he was over on Hood Canal. And when the boat got to the dock, it was a car, and they had to manhandle the car onto the boat the way they would load freight. So, you know, they lifted it, carried it up a ramp or pushed it up a ramp, and then had to lift it onto the boat and set it crosswise over the bow between the mast and the bow of the boat. So it was, I have seen a picture that had two cars loaded that way. Now, what's our biggest ferry to Vashon? 124 cars. You know, when demand grew, you weren't going to load even 9 cars on a steamboat.
Mm-hmm. So there were no drive-on boats that are considered part of the Mosquito Fleet?
No, not until after 1920. And then when it was clear that it was the end of the steamboat era, they adapted. This was what they had to do to survive. And so if you were a big enough boat, you could be converted to a ferry boat. So the Chippewa and the Indianapolis, which came big boats, steel hulled boats that came to us from the Great Lakes, were converted to ferries and could carry, you know, a fair number of cars. But they were single-ended so that you had to load and unload from the same end. So there were problems with the adaptations.
It's interesting. I think you talked about either the beginning or the end. What would you consider the dates of the beginning and the end of the Mosquito Fleet?
1840 to 1940.
Okay. Oh, 100 years.
100 years.
Okay.
Wow.
Now, it was largely over. By 1930, most of the steamboat Mosquito Fleet was gone. But I can date it to the last boat here on Vashon, which was the Concordia. And it was withdrawn from its quartermaster to Tacoma route in 1940. And that was the last one that served our community.
When did the Washington State Ferry System get established? What is the date of that?
Oh, well, that's a whole other topic.
Sure. Yeah.
So the very short version is that Vashon asked the state that we had a ferry committee, and they ran a ferry boat service between Seattle and Vashon, and they demonstrated to the state of Washington that it was possible to have a public entity run a ferry system, small though it was. But that was the impetus, and that was 1951?
Yeah, 51 is when the Washington State Ferry Systems formed. And then they incorporate the Vashon Ferry District into that. But actually, the very first public ferry was a King County ferry that ran from Portage, so near where the fishing pier is, to Des Moines. Mm-hmm. And that was the first purpose-built car ferry on Vashon
Island.
And
that was 1916 for that?
1916, yeah. So that was the first, and that was a King County ferry. Mm-hmm. And so it sort of began to establish that idea that, you know, counties, government units are responsible for roads and ferries or marine highways. And so it goes back to that 1916 King County ferry.
But it took a long time, decades.
Right. So if the Mosquito Fleet kind of died in 1940, about, you said, and the Washington State ferries didn't start until 51, what do we do between 40 and 51? There's 11 years there. Is there a...
Well, there was Kitsap Transportation Company, and then there was a Puget Sound Navigation, and that became the Black Ball Line.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm.
And then there was a lot of trouble because the people that worked on the ferry boats worked really long hours, and there was no well, they got wages, but they were very, very low wages, so they had strikes, and I mean, that's a whole era where a growth period in which it was chaos, basically. And it was especially bad at the end of World War II because there had been, out of deference to all of the effort needing to go to the war, there were no raises in pay for any of the workers on the ferries. So there were strikes and there were, you know, no services at all during those times. And a lot of competition and conflict between the Puget Sound, the Black Ball Line, and the Washington or the King County Ferry District, and so it's a tumultuous time.
Yeah, but basically, as a Mosquito fleet fades away, what you have is a privately owned ferry system, Kitsap, you know, transportation, and then Puget Sound navigation, which is called the Black Ball Line. And they actually still run the ferry from Port Angeles to Victoria. That's the last remnant of the Black Ball fleet. When Peabody sold all of his routes and ferries to the state of Washington, that's the one he kept. So that period from the late 30s when Peabody was consolidating his monopoly, and then World War II, sort of everybody agreed there'd be no strikes, there'd be no ferry increases, there'd be no wage increases. And then after the war, it was chaos. And what led to the formation of the Vashon Ferry District was a three-week strike. And Vashon just said, hey, we're going to run our own ferries. And by God, they did.
Sounds kind of typical of Vashon.
Yeah. I do not recommend that today.
No.
I don't know. Mary Jo Barentine, whose dad was the chairman of that committee, told us at the museum one time that her dad was so sick of getting phone calls at night from people who said, I need a boat to town. I mean, people were not shy about calling because they had your phone number and would call and complain or would call and ask for special services. No. So they didn't want to do it anymore.
Exactly.
And I'm kind of curious, just on the uniquely Vashon piece, you know, obviously we've been an island, but how did the Vashon Mosquito Fleet sort of differ? Or, you know, there's all kinds of things going on in the South Sound, right? And were we moving different kinds of things on our Mosquito Fleet? Was it, you know, was the sort of technology on the boats different? How are we different from how the rest of the Salish was served? Did we have more service, less?
Each community adapted, I think, in its own way to receive the services they needed. They needed to move people. They needed to move freight. Those were the essentials. And it depended on who you had. You know, the Gig Harbor area had the Hunts. Lake Bay had the Lawrences in the South Sound. Those were the big movers down there. A lot of interaction between the Gig Harbor, well, even the Lake Bay boats, because, you know, Christensen, the Virginia of Virginia Five fame, bought boats from both those people and converted them to his uses. Matthew McDowell bought a boat from the Lorenzes and converted it. So there's a lot of interaction between the communities. In the South Sound, they formed a cooperative called Bay Island, because, you know, they're all bays and islands down there, and pulled their services to get their products to market in a reasonable way. We had our services looked at who needed to be moved and what needed to be moved, and kind of made a division between what went up the East Pass and what went up the West Pass. And but essentially, they needed to do the same thing, move products, move people. And we didn't do so much towing on our side. The South Sound, they tended to use their steamboats to tow logs and barges and things like that, too.
But, you know, Vashon, really, I mean, were there products to export? I mean, I guess maybe...
agriculture.
Agricultural products.
Yes. But strawberries, big deal.
Oh, yeah.
But basically, there. I mean, in terms of bringing stuff to the island, I guess there would be... Foodstuffs.
Everything you need on the island, you know, every tool, every, you know. What's interesting to me is
bricks.
Yeah, bricks, of course, early on bricks.
And possibly milled lumber, because we did have mills. But I would say agriculture would be the big one.
That's the big one, What's fascinating about Vashon is like South Sound is kind of an enclave in its own right. You know, all that Olympia and Lake Bay and, you know, all that area down in there. And north of Vashon, you know, it's all point to point. You know, it's Bremerton to Seattle or Seattle to Bainbridge or, you know, Kingston to Mukilteo or, you know, to Whidbey Island, you know, up in the San Juans. Vashon had Tacoma and Seattle at both ends. And so almost all of the routes ran between Tacoma and Seattle and would stop at Vashon on the way up and the way back. That didn't happen in that many other places. They were more back and forth kind of ferries. But Vashon, because of its unique place between Seattle and Tacoma and the fact that we have an East Pass and a West Pass, meant you really had two different ferry systems and then a ferry system in the Quartermaster Harbor. You didn't see that with many other places because they were all sort of enclaves in their own right.
I would think maybe in the San Juans you might have something similar, but...
You did, but again, they tended to come out of Anacortes and Victoria, and they tended to hit all the islands on the way
to
one way or to another.
Yeah, being between, that was a kind of a saving grace, because if you're on your way... from Olympia, stopping at Tacoma. It's easy to stop at Vashon, especially on the east side. And so some of our bigger docks, you know, Vashon Landing.
Vashon Landing, those kind of things. Tom Lorenzen, who grew up at the Tahlequah Y, and not the Tahlequah, the Covos Y, if you know where the road at the Covos comes together there. He grew up at a farm there, was born in that farmhouse, died in that farmhouse. interesting guy. But he said when he was a teenager, this is in the pre-World War II, so 1930s, they would sit, he and his friends would sit on the porch and wait until they heard the Virginia Five blow their whistle to pull out of Cove, which was just south of them, because it would go to Cove across to Frangaria and another port over there and then come back to Covos. They would, when they heard it leaving, you know, Cove, they take off running, and by the time they got to Covostock, the Virginia was just pulling in, then they'd take off to Seattle. So, so it was that kind of thing where these boats would crisscross, both in the east and west. They just didn't hit Vashon. They hit the Kitsap Peninsula side. They hit the Seattle side. They sort of zigzagged their way up the sound.
Wow.
Innovative.
Well, it was it was commercial. I mean, that's how they made
whatever
their money.
Made money at the time.
That's absolutely right.
So I'm sure that there are many, many stories that you've collected over time. Do you have any favorites?
Oh, I have too many favorites.
Do we have another 3 hours? Is that what you're saying?
How much time do we have?
No, don't tell us, please.
We have 12 more minutes.
You're in trouble now. Well, I don't know. They're all good stories. I probably should talk about Gert Wyman for a minute. You'll have to pardon me for just a second.
Gertrude Wyman was a woman who lived here on Vashon Island, and her husband Chance Wyman was also a captain. And Jean will tell you a little bit about Gertrude. She was a fascinating character.
The Wymans were married in the 1890s, and shortly after came to Vashon. And by this time, he had his captain's license. And she didn't like being stuck at home all day. She liked being on the boat with her husband. But because she was not a licensed member of the crew, she was not allowed into the pilot house. So she said, enough of this. And so she got her license. And, you know, she had to train for it, of course.
Yeah.
And she was an equally competent captain on the Verona and the other boat that they ran. You know, she had more than one talent there. So that she's kind of famous for being the first woman licensed pilot on the Sound. And she was the prototype for Tugboat Annie when they made that movie in the 1930s.
Really? Wow.
And came back then in her retirement. They had a race, for, I don't know, Tugboat Harbor Days or
it was
something.
It was positioned as the last steamboat race on Puget Sound.
Yes.
And it was between the Virginia Five and a boat called the Vashona. Which had been renamed.
That sounds familiar. Yeah,
which had been renamed the Sightseer by that time. It had been bought by Gray Lines and had been renamed the Sightseer. But that was the last steamboat race on Puget Sound. It was the way it was built in like 1947, 48, something like that.
Who won?
The Virginia. Five. Virginia 5-1.
And you named your boat after the underdog?
Of course. Vashon's always the underdog, right? Yeah. But they brought Gertrude out of retirement.
Well, in an interview before that race, I'm pretty sure it's this same race, she said, well, you know, she would pour on the fuel and she would use the furniture if she had to. And so the reporter very timidly pointed out to her that the boat was entirely diesel fueled now. There was no steam. And she said, I'll throw it in anyway. But she did lose the race.
Oh, well.
That's one of my favorite stories.
Yeah. What about the story about the petticoats on the West Passage?
Which one?
The petticoats.
Oh, the petticoats.
That's a great story.
There's a teaser.
Yeah. Well, now I just have dreams of a steamboat race on, you know, on the Sound. Yeah. So I want to see that now. I don't know if we could do a steamboat or, I don't know, how fast does the Virginia 5 go these days?
Well, when we take her around the island, she does about seven and a half knots.
She goes slow.
Yeah, she can go faster, but I think they're trying to limit the wear and tear on the engine because it's the original old steam engine.
Oh, it's old.
Yeah.
It's from the Tyrus, and it was new in 1903, I think.
Right. Yep.
And it was a triple expansion steam reciprocating engine, very famous for its efficiency. And they work hard to keep it tippy-tippy top.
The Heritage Museum, I think it's on August 19th this year, we'll do another trip around the island on the Virginia 5. We do that every summer. And it's a great way to see the island from the water. But it's also a great way to go down in the engine room and see that triple expansion steam engine at work. I mean, it's all open. The cylinders
Just keep your hands just by your side.
Exactly. Don't take young children down there.
Polished brass. It is just gorgeous. And the Lorenzas, when they sold it, they had an eagle emblem. And that's mounted on the engine. So it's there to be viewed, too. So it's worth it. Not to look at the shore, but just to look at the engine. So wonderful. Well, I'll tell you the story about the petticoats. This is Captain John Vanderhoof, and at this time he was captain on the Iola, which ran up the West Pass, and about 1887. And he had remodeled the boat. Often captains lived on the boat because they wanted to be ready to go whenever they would get a job, so living on the boat was real efficient for them. So he was married, and his wife traveled on the boat with him. And I think Billy Phillips was the deckhand on this trip, and he's a famous Vashon mariner and was captain on a ferry boat finally at the end of his career. Well, and I noticed when I was doing research on this that we had a lot more fog than we have now. I'm not quite sure why. Climate change, I suppose. So one foggy morning on the West Pass, they were all in the pilot house, and Mrs. Vanderhoof said that, well, she would go down and she would red up the cabin for lunch. Well, it turns out she was from the East Coast, and this was a common expression back there to red up something. What it just meant was you were going to go and tidy it up, clean it up, get it ready for lunch. So she either shook a tablecloth or a rug, I'm not sure which, over the side of the boat, but she lost her balance and she fell into the water.
Oh.
And she yelled for help, apparently, but... you know, it was a steam engine, and it was noisy. And the captain and the deckhand did not hear her call. And they had gone quite a long way. I'm not sure they got all the way to Seattle. I think maybe not quite that far. But they went down to the cabin, assuming lunch would be ready. And there was no lunch, and there was no Mrs. Vanderhoof. So they couldn't. She wasn't visible, and they decided the only thing they could do was retrace their route back the way they had come. And they finally got all the way back to Colvo's, and there she was on the beach. And when she fell overboard, she did not drown because she was wearing a wide skirt with these voluminous petticoats underneath it. And the air that got trapped underneath them held her up in the water.
You're kidding.
And she screamed for help. Thomas Redding was on the beach cutting wood, and he heard her calling. And he got in his rowboat, and he went out and brought her into shore, built a fire. When Captain Vanderhoof got back, she was almost dry. But she was alive, she was well, and Captain Vanderhoof said, I thought for sure the devil had had her that time.
That time.
And I bet she was one mad lady, don't you?
I think so. Yeah. But I wondered why he said, you know, why the devil had had her that time. There are other stories about her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that time kind of stands out.
But she liked to visit with people at docks. And so she got off one day and visited with the women on the dock, and Vanderhoof was conscious that they were on a schedule and he wanted to try and keep to it. So he left without her.
Oh, boy.
And boy, did he hear about it after. He never left her behind again.
Those are good.
Yeah, I love it.
If you want more, I've got more.
Oh, yeah.
We're down to the last.
Yeah, I was going to say, we'll probably get to see some of those stories at the museum, will we not?
We will.
Yeah.
We will.
Oh, this is great.
Yeah.
So, Gene, we're just the last few minutes here before we have to sign off. Give us some words of wisdom about, you know, what have you learned about the mosquito fleet, about the struggles of the mosquito fleet that makes sense for us today and for Amy? I mean, what can Amy take away from this so she can go out there and do battle with the enemies of the ferry system?
Well, I think one of my takeaways from looking at that whole era was how creative and adaptive the captains were in trying to meet the needs of their customers and trying to, they were conscious that they needed to keep schedules and they tried hard, but they weren't going to leave someone standing on a float somewhere waving a handkerchief just to keep to a schedule. So they were sympathetic as well. I mean, they were conscious, of course, that they needed the custom, but they weighed their priorities, and their priorities were their customers. Their priorities were their customers. Mm-hmm. And I think we lose sight of that kind of now with the problems we have personally here with our ferry schedule. People need to get to work on time, and if you're old like me, you need to get to your doctor's appointment on time. You know, there are lots of reasons for going to town, not just for pleasure or shopping like we might have done at one time. And I think the other thing is that they anticipate need, the mosquito fleet people did. Emmett Hunt at Gig Harbor knew a year ahead of time that Baby Mine was not going to live a lot longer, his first boat. And he pre-planned, did the design, and did the building, and had a boat ready to go when she gave up the ghost. Mm. So that anticipation of need and getting it in place, that's an important component, I think, that we could, we should have. I think we knew there were problems, but we didn't act on it in time.
Great. Amy, you want to tell us about the meeting tonight real quick?
Yes, the WSF information, public information meeting.
Yeah.
Yes, I do not have the website address is very long, but Washington State Ferry's Steve Nevy is having the second of their public information meetings. And if you go ahead and Google it, hit the Google machine and ask for WSF or Washington State Ferry's public information meeting and today's date, it should take you there. You do need to pre-register because it is a Zoom meeting.
Great, thanks. Well, Gene, thank you. It's been an enlightening conversation. And if you have a chance, pick up Gene and Robin Patterson's book, The Mosquito Fleet of South Puget Sound. It's available at the museum when we open in July, and it's available at the Vashon Bookshop, and it's available on Amazon. And so, Gene, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
For Gene, Amy, Craig, Truman, and me, thanks for joining the Brief Lease today. We'll see you next week.